I rush past the door and charge down the stairs as fast as I can without falling. I hustle to the door. I need a vehicle. Mom, can I borrow your car? I wipe a lone tear from my lash. It's not really crying if it's only one. Sure, honey. The keys are in my purse. You better hurry. Remember what your dad said. The stores close early today, she yells back at me from the kitchen. As I grab the keys from her turkey-beaded purse, I push the home button on my phone. Yikes. It's almost noon. I do not need any more setbacks. A tear drops from my other lash. I will not cry over pecan pie. Huh, that rhymes. I hop into my mom's car and inhale. She always has a flavorful car scent. I check out the dangling piece of cardboard shaped like a pie hanging from her rearview mirror. Pecan. I take a deep breath and put the car in reverse. My map program searches.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 66 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Hello, welcome to your coronavirus update for Monday, November 2nd, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael, and here are some of the stories that we'll be reading today. Nearly 50,000 Americans are hospitalized with coronavirus as experts warn of growing healthcare pressure. Household spread of COVID-19 is common and quick, a new CDC study finds. Senior COVID-19 patients suffer brain fog and drawn-out recovery. Advisors to CDC discuss potential coronavirus vaccines. COVID-19 spreads as people pass it along to someone they live with. Why the U.S. has a problem with hospital capacity. And how COVID-19 is influencing voters' ballots. Those stories and more are coming up this hour. We'll look at the numbers first. From the Odessa American, Ector County last updated COVID-19 numbers Friday afternoon. Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 6,547. Ector County negative, 26,427. Out of 33,345 tested, with 371 pending, 21 deaths. Recovered, 5,372. Active, 1,054. Midland County, 5,540 confirmed, 96 deaths. From the Midland ISD COVID-19 dashboard, total confirmed cases are now up to 320. Cases in October, 203. Midland Memorial Hospital statistics, the only hospital that I can find statistics for this. They have 47 of their 50 rooms for COVID patients occupied at this time, which is unchanged. From the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased by 894 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 1st, 4,111 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 485 patients compared with a week ago. As of November 1st, 5,691 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths increased by 12 deaths in Texas compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 1st, 53 new deaths were reported. Here are coronavirus briefs. The United States topped 62,000 new coronavirus cases on Thursday, the country's highest daily count since it reported more than 66,000 cases on July 31st. Cases in the Midwest began to surge during October. On Thursday, Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, North Dakota, Montana, New Mexico, and Colorado tallied new single-day highs for positive test results. 14 states exceeded their 7-day averages of new infections. From Alaska to Maine, at least 31 U.S. states reported at least one record high day of new coronavirus cases in the past month, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. At least 216,522 fatalities in the United States have been attributed to the coronavirus since February, with more than 7.9 million cases reported. Two people involved with Democrat Joe Biden's presidential campaign have tested positive for the coronavirus, officials announced Thursday. Neither person had contact with Biden or his running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, for at least 2 days before their diagnoses, according to the campaign. But Harris has nevertheless canceled all her travel through the weekend. Remdesivir, an antiviral drug by Gilead Sciences, does not prevent deaths or shorten hospital stays for coronavirus patients, according to a World Health Organization study published Thursday. Holding large family gatherings at Thanksgiving this year may be unwise, particularly if elderly relatives or out-of-state travel are involved. The nation's top infectious disease expert, Anthony Fauci, told CBS Evening News on Wednesday. Fauci recommends Americans bite the bullet and keep their distance, adding he would heed his own advice. His three children will not be coming home for Thanksgiving because his age puts him at an elevated risk. Oxford scientists develop 5-minute coronavirus antigen test. Young healthy people may have to wait until 2022 for vaccine, a top World Health Organization scientist says. British media have revealed that Prince William, second in line to the British throne, tested positive for the coronavirus earlier in the year, but didn't tell anyone. World Health Organization's Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus announced on Sunday that he would self-quarantine after coming into contact with a confirmed case of COVID-19. Israel has administered the first dose of COVID-19 vaccine in Phase 1 clinical trials. Now, here are some short articles. Oil prices tumble as lockdowns stoke recession fears, from CNN's Hannah Zaidi. Oil prices fell sharply on Monday as new lockdowns across Europe and record coronavirus cases in the United States slammed the outlook for energy demand. Brent crude, the global benchmark, fell as much as 5% in early morning trading in Asia, touching levels last seen in May, before pairing losses to trade at 2% lower at $37.13 a barrel. West Texas Intermediate, the U.S. benchmark, was down 2.49% at $34.90 a barrel. Decisions by European governments to impose another round of severe coronavirus restrictions are weighing on sentiment. France, Germany, and Belgium are going back into nationwide lockdowns, shutting restaurants and non-essential businesses for several weeks and restricting travel. In the United Kingdom, authorities are introducing a lockdown in England that is scheduled to run through December 2nd. These four countries consume the equivalent of a little over 6% of global consumption, so no surprise that we are seeing the market reacting this morning. ING's head of commodities strategy, Warren Patterson, and senior commodities strategist Wenyu Yao wrote in a research note on Monday. The dose of coronavirus a person gets may determine how sick they get. Masks could help. From CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta and Andrea Kane. The dose of coronavirus you're exposed to might make the difference between being asymptomatic, getting mildly sick, or becoming critically ill. The concept of needing a certain dose of a pathogen, a disease-causing organism, to trigger an infection has been shown to be the case for many viruses, such as influenza, pox viruses, and others, explained Aaron Bromage, an associate professor of biology at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. If you hit an animal with a low enough dose, they'll be able to fend that off without developing any disease at all. If you get a magic number of an infectious dose, an infection will establish, and that animal will then succumb to the disease from that particular pathogen. But if you hit them with more than the infectious dose, in most situations, a high dose of pathogens, like a high dose of a virus, for example, leads to more severe outcomes, Bromage said. So dose really becomes important. It's not because you need a certain number of particles of virus to infect a cell. It just increases the odds that one of those viral particles will make it into the cell and infect it, setting off the chain reaction. The virus itself isn't the only organism that plays a role. It also has to do with the individual. Each person has a different amount of virus that they need, said Bromage. Somebody that is immunosuppressed or somebody that is stressed, for example, may need less of a virus challenge in order to get the same outcomes as somebody that is in a healthy condition. If the dose is small enough, it may not cause illness, but could still generate an immune response similar to a vaccine. Nearly 50,000 Americans are hospitalized with the coronavirus, from CNN's Madeleine Holcomb. The fall surge has left nearly 50,000 people hospitalized across the U.S. due to COVID-19, and experts say the strain healthcare systems are under could soon get worse. Hospitalizations were on the rise in 47 states last month, according to the COVID Tracking Project, and a total of 47,502 people were hospitalized as of Sunday. The rates come alongside a surge of cases that made October a record-setting month for coronavirus infections in the U.S. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, expects Thanksgiving to be an inflection point and has said the American hospital system is going to be facing pressure similar to the early spikes when hospitals around the country were reaching capacity and healthcare workers were stretched thin. We're right at the beginning of what looks like exponential growth in a lot of states, Gottlieb told CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday. This is very worrisome as we head into the winter. Experts have said the impacts will likely continue to get worse as the colder months drive up infections. Household spread of COVID-19 is common and quick, a new CDC study finds, by Sandy Lamott and Virginia Langmaid, CNN. The spread of COVID-19 among members in a household after one person is infected is common and occurs quickly after illness onset, according to a new study from the Centers for U.S. Disease Control and Prevention. The person exposed or suspected of having COVID-19 should be isolated before getting tested and before test results come back to protect others in the home, said the study, published Friday in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Because prompt isolation of persons with COVID-19 can reduce household transmission, persons who suspect they might have COVID-19 should isolate, stay at home, and use a separate bedroom and bathroom if feasible, wrote a CDC-led team of researchers. In addition, all members of the household should wear masks at all times in common spaces, the team said. Infection of others happened within days. The research, part of an ongoing CDC-supported study, followed 101 people initially infected with COVID-19 in Nashville, Tennessee, and Marshfield, Wisconsin, between April and September. Along with some 191 others who lived in their households, the infected people were trained to self-collect specimens, nasal swabs only, or nasal swabs and saliva samples, each day for 14 days. In addition, each person completed a symptom diary. Infection was quick. Over half of the people, 53%, who lived with someone battling COVID-19 became infected within a week, researchers found. Some 75% of these secondary infections occurred within 5 days of the first symptoms in the initial patient. Substantial transmission occurred whether the patient index was an adult or a child, researchers said. A 53% household infection rate, the study said, is higher than what has been documented so far. To date, related research has reported only a 20 to 40% infection rate. An important finding of this study is that fewer than one half of household members with confirmed SARS-CoV-2 infections reported symptoms at the time infection was first detected, the study authors wrote. Many reported no symptoms throughout 7 days of follow-up, underscoring the potential for transmission from asymptomatic secondary contacts and the importance of quarantine. Isolate yourself or your loved one. Staying isolated from other household members can be challenging, especially if you are in a small space or there are children in the home. If you have somebody at home who's older or immunocompromised, you might want to isolate them to one side of the house so the kids and everybody else aren't around them on a regular basis, said pediatrician Dr. Tanya Altman, editor-in-chief of the American Academy of Pediatrics book, Caring for Your Baby and Young Child, Birth to Age 5 and the Wonder Years, in a prior interview. If it's a child that you have to take care of, then you may have to make the decision to isolate one adult with the child, she added. That adult would be caring for the child, and the other adult would be responsible for the rest of the family. And of course, all of this will be extremely difficult for a single parent who might be the only one, said pediatrician Dr. Jenny Radesky, a spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics, in a prior interview. Know who your neighbors are, even what your neighborhood social network might be, said Radesky, an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Michigan. You may not be that close interpersonally, but someone may be willing to do a grocery store drop-off or pick up medications because we're all in this together. The rest of the family should practice isolation as well, Radesky added. Unfortunately, you need to keep the whole household under isolation, she said. The patterns of COVID-19 spread suggests that clusters of people who live close together are at highest risk of getting it from one another. If children are part of that household, they may show minimal symptoms but still be contagious. If you live alone, your challenge is to monitor your symptoms and care for yourself when you're not feeling well. Be sure to have a plan in place to get food and medications delivered to your home, and find someone who can be responsible for virtually checking in on you on a regular basis. Stock or ask loved ones to provide the room with all relevant forms of entertainment, TV, computer, iPad, books, even games that you could play via FaceTime or Skype. Senior COVID-19 patients suffer brain fog and drawn-out recovery, by Judith Graham, Kaiser Health News. Lord, give me back my memory. For months, as Marilyn Walters struggled to recover from COVID-19, she has repeated this prayer day and night. Like other older adults who have become critically ill from the coronavirus, Walters, 65, describes what she calls brain fog, difficulty putting thoughts together, problems with concentration, the inability to remember what happened a short time before. This sudden cognitive dysfunction is a common concern for seniors who have survived a serious bout of COVID-19. Many older patients are having trouble organizing themselves and planning what they need to do to get through the day, said Dr. Zhejian Chen, medical director for Center for Post-COVID Care at Mount Sinai Health System in New York City. They're reporting that they've become more and more forgetful. Other challenges abound: overcoming muscle and nerve damage, improving breathing, adapting to new impairments, regaining strength and stamina, and coping with the emotional toll of an unexpected illness. Most seniors survive COVID-19 and will encounter these concerns to varying degrees. Even among the age group at greatest risk, people 85 and older, just 28% of those with confirmed cases end up dying, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Because of gaps in testing, the actual death rate may be lower. Walters, who lives in Indianapolis, spent almost 3 weeks in March and April, heavily sedated, on a ventilator, fighting for her life in intensive care. Today, she said, I still get tired real easy, and I can't breathe sometimes. If I'm walking, sometimes my legs get wobbly and my arms get like jelly. Emotionally, it's been hard because I've always been able to do for myself, and I can't do that as I like. I've been really nervous and jittery, Walter said. Younger adults who have survived a serious course of COVID-19 experience similar issues, but older adults tend to have more severe symptoms and more limitations in terms of what they can do, Chen said. Recovery will be on the order of months and years, not days or weeks, said Dr. E. Wesley Eli, co-director of the Critical Illness, Brain Dysfunction, and Survivorship Center at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Most likely, he speculated, a year after fighting the disease, at least half of the critically ill older patients will not be fully recovered. The after effects of delirium, an acute sudden change of consciousness and mental acuity, can complicate recovery from COVID-19. Seniors hospitalized for serious illness are susceptible to the often unrecognized condition when they're immobilized for a long time, isolated from family and friends, and given sedatives to ease agitation or narcotics for pain, among other contributing factors. In older adults, delirium is associated with a heightened risk of losing independence, developing dementia, and dying. It can manifest as acute confusion and agitation, or as uncharacteristic unresponsiveness and lethargy. What we're seeing with COVID-19 in older adults are rates of delirium in the 70 to 80% range, said Dr. Babar Khan, Associate Director of Indiana University's Center for Aging Research at the Regenstrief Institute and one of Walter's physicians. Gordon Quinn, 77, a Chicago documentary filmmaker, believes he contracted COVID-19 at a conference in Australia in early March. At Northwestern Memorial Hospital, he was put on a ventilator twice in the ICU for a total of nearly 2 weeks and remembers having a lot of hallucinations, a symptom of delirium. I remember vividly believing I was in purgatory. I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. I could hear snatches of TV, reruns of Law & Order Special Victims Unit, and I asked myself, is this my life for eternity? Quinn said. Given the extent of delirium and mounting evidence of neurological damage from COVID-19, Khan said he expected to see an increased prevalence of ICU-acquired cognitive impairment in older COVID patients. Eli agreed. These patients will urgently need to work on recovery, he said. Family members should insist on securing rehabilitation services, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, cognitive rehabilitation, after the patient leaves the hospital and returns home, he advised. Even at my age, people can get incredible benefit from rehab, said Quinn, who spent nearly 2 weeks at Chicago's Shirley Ryan Ability Lab, a rehabilitation hospital, before returning home and getting several weeks of home-based therapy. Today, he's able to walk nearly 2 miles and has returned to work, feeling almost back to normal. James Telaganis, 72, of Indian Head Park, Illinois, also benefited from rehab at Shirley Ryan Ability Lab after spending nearly 4 months in various hospitals beginning in early May. Telaganis had a complicated case of COVID-19. His kidneys failed, and he was put on dialysis. He experienced cardiac arrest and was in a coma for almost 58 days while on a ventilator. He had intestinal bleeding, requiring multiple blood transfusions, and was found to have crystallization and fibrosis in his lungs. When Telaganis began his rehab on August 22nd, he said, "My whole body, my muscles were atrophied. I couldn't get out of bed or go to the toilet. I was getting fed through a tube. I couldn't eat solid foods." In early October, after getting hours of therapy each day, Telaganis was able to walk 660 feet in 6 minutes and eat whatever he wanted. "My memory, it's a miracle. Every day I feel better," he said. Unfortunately, rehabilitation needs for most older adults are often overlooked. Notably, a recent study found that one-third of critically ill older adults who survive a stay in the ICU did not receive rehab services at home after hospital discharge. Seniors who live in more rural areas or outside bigger cities where major hospital systems are providing cutting-edge services are at a significant risk of losing out on this potentially restorative care, said Dr. Sean Smith, an associate professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at the University of Michigan. Sometimes what's most needed for recovery from critical illness is human connection. That was true for Tom and Virginia Stevens of Nashville, Tennessee, in their late 80s, who were both hospitalized with COVID-19 in early August. Eli, one of their physicians, found them in separate hospital rooms, frightened and miserable. "I'm worried about my husband," he said Virginia told him. "Where am I? What is happening? Where is my wife?" the doctor said Tom asked, before crying out, I have to get out of here." Eli and another physician taking care of the couple agreed. Being isolated from each other was dangerous for this couple, married for 66 years. They needed to be put in a room together. When the doctor walked into their new room the next day, he said it was a night and day difference. The couple was sipping coffee, eating, and laughing on beds that had been pushed together. "They both got better from that point on. I know that was because of the loving touch, being together," Eli said. That doesn't mean recovery has been easy. Virginia and Tom still struggle with confusion, fatigue, weakness, and anxiety after their 2-week stay in the hospital, followed by 2 weeks in inpatient rehabilitation. Now they're in a new assisted living residence, which is allowing outdoor visits with their family. "Doctors have told us it will take a long time and they may never get back to where they were before COVID," said their daughter, Karen Krieger, also of Nashville. "But that's okay. I'm just so grateful that they came through this and we get to spend more time with them." Now we're going to bring you a series of pre-recorded reports. We will bring you a report now that's related to an earlier piece we read, why the U.S. has a problem with hospital capacity. We also have a story about COVID-19 spreads as people pass it along to someone they live with. And then advisors to CDC discuss potential coronavirus vaccines.
You may be surprised to learn that the U.S. has fewer hospitals and hospital beds per capita than almost all other industrial nations, including Italy, France, and the U.K. That's according to analysis by the Peterson Center on Healthcare and the Kaiser Family Foundation. We wanted to learn more about why this is the case and how it could be affecting efforts to combat the coronavirus pandemic. So we've called Nancy Foster. She is Vice President for Quality and Patient Safety Policy at the American Hospital Association, and she's with us now. Nancy Foster, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure to be with you today. Thank you, Michelle.
So before we jump in, as we mentioned, there are surges across the country, and I'm imagining as part of your work, you're hearing from hospitals across the country about what they're experiencing. Like, what are some of the top lines that they're telling you?
You are exactly right. We are hearing from hospitals across the country. They are concerned because there are growing numbers of positive patients in their communities. Many of our members are already reaching capacity or have really struggled to keep enough staff on duty in order to care for all who are coming to them.
So it's a staffing problem as well as an infrastructure problem.
It is.
So I want to talk about that infrastructure issue. I mean, according to data analysis by the Peterson Center on Healthcare and the Kaiser Family Foundation that we cited earlier, the U.S. actually has fewer hospitals and hospital beds per capita than other industrialized nations, including Italy, China, and South Korea. This is before the pandemic. Why is that?
In the U.S., we tend to use our hospitals to care for only those who are critically ill or, for instance, giving birth to a baby. Our length of stay in hospitals is generally less than that in other countries, so we tend to keep people in the hospital less time. We send them home to recuperate and provide support to them while they're at home, or if they need additional support, we send them to skilled nursing facilities or rehab facilities in order to recuperate from whatever brought them to the hospital in the first place.
So this reflects what, a different philosophy about how care should be delivered?
It does, a different utilization of the facilities.
What happens, though, if a hospital gets overwhelmed? What does that affect their ability to do?
Each of these jurisdictions has a plan for what to do when there is an emergency that overwhelms an individual hospital. And that plan will draw on other resources in the community, and that plan will also draw on available resources from the federal government WRF from hospitals across the country in sort of a volunteer effort to step forward and help each other out. We've seen nurses and doctors from other parts of the country voluntarily move to hard-hit communities in order to support the caregivers there. The challenge we're facing right now is that the outbreak is so widespread that it's harder to find critical healthcare workers who are available to move into some of those hardest-hit areas. And so it is an ongoing challenge for us to try to meet the needs of patients in all areas of the country right now.
So before we let you go, as we know, we're nearing the end of this election season. No matter who wins the election, we know that this health crisis will be with us for a while. And a number of commentators have observed that this crisis has laid bare issues that needed to be addressed anyway, you know, about issues around access to healthcare and things of the like, and as well as a number of issues, safety issues, the access to protective equipment, all these other supply chain issues. Is there something that you would point attention to that this crisis has revealed that you think the public should be aware of anyway when it comes to the question of hospital capacity or the ability of hospitals having what they need to serve the country in the days that in the days and months ahead? Has something been revealed that you think people should know about anyway?
This virus has tested our ability to work collaboratively as a team across the healthcare continuum, keeping us integrated from public health to hospital to physician office to post-acute care setting or nursing homes, so that we are effectively working as a collaborative team is something that has been absolutely necessary in this pandemic, and something we need to work on for the future so that we are better caring for individuals in our communities.
That is Nancy Foster, Vice President of Quality and Patient Safety Policy at the American Hospital Association. Nancy Foster, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Michelle.
Coronavirus infections are at an all-time high. The United States documented nearly 100,000 new cases in one day over the weekend, and this comes as we learn more about how the virus can spread within a household. Let's talk about this and all the information we need in this pandemic with NPR's Allison Aubrey, who joins us most Mondays. Hi, Allison.
Good morning, David.
Okay, let's first dig into the numbers, as we often do. What are we seeing in the United States right now, and what does it tell us about where we might be headed here?
Sure. New cases have been averaging about 80,000 per day. That's about a 40% increase compared to mid-October. And with this has come an increase in deaths over the last several days. Nearly 1,000 people in the U.S. have died from COVID per day on average. And perhaps the best measure of where we're headed, hospitalizations. Some hospitals are filling up. For instance, hospital beds in metropolitan areas, including Atlanta, Minneapolis, Baltimore, were at 80% capacity or above as of last week. And cases continue to rise in these areas, David.
I mean, we're already hearing about some European countries going to more lockdowns. Are we going to see new restrictions here in the United States?
Yeah, we're already seeing some. In parts of New Jersey, Illinois, there are new restrictions on businesses. Last week, a judge in El Paso County, Texas, issued a type of shutdown order for non-essential businesses. In Maine, bars were set to reopen this week, but that is now not happening. And Governor Janet Mills announced other measures, including lowering the limits on indoor gatherings. Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb said yesterday, we are probably going to need more aggressive actions to control the spread around the nation.
Things are getting worse around the country. I think Thanksgiving is really going to be an inflection point. I think December is probably going to be our toughest month. But when you look at what's happening in states right now, you're seeing accelerating spread. We're right at the beginning of what looks like exponential growth in a lot of states. So this is very worrisome as we head into the winter.
You know, there's probably not the kind of support for nationwide lockdown here that people in England are preparing for. There, it means everything from pubs and restaurants to gyms, places of worship, and non-essential businesses are set to close.
Well, can we talk about how this is spreading? I mean, we've talked about so-called super spreader events, but the CDC released a new report that talks about just how easily the virus can spread within a household, right?
Yeah. The study found that after a first person is diagnosed in a home, at least one more person is quickly infected in well over half the cases. Important to note here, David, even with children who are asymptomatic or have only mild symptoms, study found that when kids 12 and younger tested positive for the virus, they ended up spreading the virus to someone they lived with about 53% of the time. That's why people who have COVID or suspect they have COVID are urged to stay in a separate bedroom, use a separate bathroom if possible, and to wear masks, especially in shared spaces. And remember, the incubation period of the virus is up to 2 weeks. My son, who was exposed to the virus at college, tested positive on his 14th day of quarantine.
The last day. Wow.
The last day. Now, thankfully, he is asymptomatic, but the point is you cannot shortchange this isolation period.
That's amazing. He's doing okay.
He's doing all right, yeah. Thanks for asking.
I mean, most people recover from this virus, but doctors seem to be learning more about these so-called long haulers, these people who talk about experiencing symptoms, problems for a long period of time. And what are we learning about that?
You know, there's not great data on how many people have long-term symptoms, but even if it's 1%, David, that's still thousands of people. I spoke to Emily Brigham. She's a pulmonologist at Johns Hopkins, where one of the first post-COVID clinics has been set up and is now in operation. A range of doctors of different specialties, including cardiologists, neurologists, are treating patients who are experiencing a wide variety of ongoing or long-term symptoms.
Some of the commonalities are we often see persistent shortness of breath. We see many individuals with ongoing palpitations. Fatigue is a common symptom. Cognitive complaints like difficulties with memory, remembering things, or just thinking in general. And certainly changes in mood.
And she points out that this is something many of us have experienced, the change in mood that is during the pandemic, given all of the disruption to our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I know you've also been looking into sleep as an interesting side of this. I mean, disruptions for sleep, not just with people who test positive for COVID, but for all of us in a pandemic.
That's right. A couple of studies out that point to a rise in insomnia and also some interesting research into pandemic dreams, suggesting that many of us are having very vivid dreams and nightmares. I spoke to Kirsi Maria Zitting. She's a sleep researcher at Brigham and Women's Hospital. She's keeping track of how many people search Google for insomnia, and she has documented a whopping increase, David. The typical time people are online searching for insomnia is the middle of the night with a peak at 3 a.m.
But unfortunately, the number of people searching for insomnia has gone up even higher. So we think that that means that those people are pretty desperate and just searching, trying to find out what they can do to sleep better.
You know, a lack of sleep can have so many bad health effects. So this is a serious issue, David, and there are lots of ways to address it and steps you can take to prevent it.
I guess one nice thing was the extra hour of sleep we got with the time change in most of the country. I mean, that couldn't have come at a better time. But, I mean, what other strategies are there to help?
You know, with darker days ahead, it's helpful to get sunlight in the morning when you wake up. I spoke to sleep expert Mariska Brown at the National Institutes of Health about this. She says, go outside when you wake up, if you can, or just open the curtains first thing in the morning.
When we talk about getting bright light in the morning, it's getting that cue, that sunlight, that, you know, telling your internal circadian rhythms, your internal clock, that it's time to move, it's time to get up.
You know, she says she is not surprised at all that so many people are experiencing insomnia because insomnia is tied to stress. And with all the disruptions and job losses, not to mention the election, a lot of people are stressed. She says early in the pandemic, even she experienced it. So she worked on having a more routine schedule. She stopped getting online and looking at social media so much, and she made other changes.
I started getting my morning light and getting more exercise in, and it has helped me tremendously.
You know, there's just so much we cannot control, but we can work on these personal habits to try to be as healthy as possible.
And NPR's Allison Arbery helping us understand this pandemic and this moment. Allison, thanks as always.
Thank you, David.
A group of advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention met virtually today to review what's known about potential vaccines for COVID-19. Vaccines are still in clinical trials right now, but the groundwork is being set to distribute them as soon as the Food and Drug Administration authorizes them. The main issue before the advisors is, who should be the first to get a vaccine? Well, NPR's Ping Huang has been following today's meeting, and she joins us now. Hey, Ping.
Hey, Elsa.
So tell us a little more about this group that met today. Like, what exactly is their role in how a vaccine might get rolled out?
Sure. So the group is called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, and they make recommendations on every vaccine for the CDC. It's a group of medical and public health experts, mostly outside of CDC, with 15 voting members and others that weigh in. And the role in the government's plans around COVID vaccines is pretty key. So once the FDA authorizes a vaccine based on safety and efficacy, this is the group that will determine things like how many doses should be given, how far apart, and which groups of people should be getting these vaccines. And their recommendations will essentially trigger the start of the vaccine distribution process. Government officials say that as soon as this group's guidelines are accepted by the CDC, vaccines will start shipping out, and their aim is to start getting them into people's arms within 24 hours.
Okay, so that is the plan for when a vaccine is authorized. Obviously, no vaccine has gotten there yet. So what did this group discuss today?
They discussed a lot of things in preparation for that milestone. So they heard from a few vaccine makers on how their clinical trials are going, and they got an update on how states are preparing to get a vaccine out in their communities. It's still the future, but Dr. Janelle Ruth, a CDC medical officer, says that future is coming right up.
We are working towards a readiness date of November 15th based on projections of vaccine availability. We want to ensure that before product is rolled out, jurisdictions have everything in place to accept and administer vaccine.
The CDC wants states to be ready to start giving out COVID-19 vaccines as soon as the FDA okays one. And I want to emphasize that this does not mean that a vaccine will be available by November 15th. Mm-hmm. Some vaccine makers have said they might present data to the FDA then, or maybe by the end of November. But the CDC wants states to get everything ready. They want them to enroll providers and get data tracking systems up and start talking with community leaders to receive a vaccine very soon. And even when a vaccine is first available, they do expect there to be a very limited number of doses in the beginning.
Right. Okay, so then the big question, who is going to get the vaccine first? Do they know?
Well, the ACIP is not making specific recommendations until a vaccine is authorized. They say that it's because they have to look at the specific characteristics of a vaccine to figure out how it's best put to use. Their goals are to use the vaccine to reduce transmission, illness, and deaths from COVID-19. And there's a few different strategies they're considering to do that. For instance, whether it makes sense to vaccinate groups like older people or those who are pregnant early on really depends on whether the vaccine works well in their bodies. And that's something that's still unknown for a lot of these vaccines that are still in trial. The CDC did present a model today that suggested that saving lives from COVID might be more a matter of timing of when the COVID vaccine is available rather than who gets it second or third. But there seems to be a general consensus about who should get it first. It's healthcare workers. There's around 21 million of them. They get exposed to COVID regularly, and they're needed to keep our health systems running.
That is NPR's Ping Huang. Thank you, Ping.
Thank you for having me.
And for our final report, of course, the election is on everybody's mind as Election Day is tomorrow. Here's a story today from the Texas Standard, how COVID-19 is influencing voters' ballots.
One Texas region COVID-19 has hit especially hard is the Rio Grande Valley. Since the pandemic began, the virus has killed more than 3,000 people there. Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leanez Jr. talked to one RGV resident about how the virus has upended her life and motivated her to vote more than ever.
Please answer the questions below based on the circumstances.
In a headset sitting at the computer, Ana Hernandez is working remotely. From her home in McAllen, Texas, she's part of a COVID-19 task force for New York City.
Are one or more members of her household currently staying home under the advice?
Hernandez started this job months ago when the pandemic started. She worked as a medical office specialist at a clinic in the Rio Grande Valley. She says doctors weren't hearing her concerns or her colleagues.
So I quit before because of that. I said, no, these doctors are not willing to protect us.
Now, she says, she knows people who've died from coronavirus, like thousands of other Latinos.
Health-wise, COVID-19 is affecting the Latino community particularly hard.
That's Rodrigo Dominguez Villegas, Director of Research at the Latino Policy and Politics Initiative at UCLA. He's also the co-author of a report on the top issues Latino voters care about in swing states with large Latino populations.
Poll after poll is showing that the Latino voter cares a lot about health, about the economy, and most importantly about COVID-19.
One reason the virus is affecting Latinos more is because there's an overrepresentation of Latinos in essential jobs and sectors like agriculture and construction, jobs where it's hard to maintain social distance or where they're not able to work from home.
Also, there's a lot of Latinos in the health industry, so a lot of nurses, a lot of doctors are Latino.
Like Ana Hernandez. That data Dominguez Villegas analyzed shows Latino voters want to see a clear path and leadership to stop the virus, something Hernandez can relate to.
I've always been active in the communities, but this administration has changed me, my job. It's changed my family. It's changed my faith. Before, I would just vote, and sometimes I vote Republican. But because of this administration, we just changed our ways of looking into everything.
The virus and the election have disrupted her home life, too. Hernandez has three adult children. One son and her daughter are voting for Vice President Biden. As for her other son,
I have a young son. He's 26. He, for some reason, doesn't think, like many other people, think that this is not serious. He listens to Trump, so he doesn't take precautions.
She remembers one night.
I couldn't sleep, just thinking this virus is going to kill one of us. It's going to kill my daughter. Maybe it's going to kill my husband or me. And it was because of him.
Her daughter is a cancer survivor.
I love him. But they got to the point that I said, okay, you can stay home. You want to be out, going to your barbershop, going to bars. I cannot sleep because you do this. I'm going to ask you to leave the house.
Hernandez is in a slight majority in Texas. According to a Dallas Morning News and University of Texas at Tyler poll, Biden is leading with 48% of support from Texas likely voters, while President Trump is polling at 45%. And among Latinos, Biden is polling better than Trump. Hernandez says she went to vote early. In line, she heard her thoughts echoed by fellow voters.
And I was listening to conversations. They seem to have gone up early to vote and they want to change. That's what I was observing. People that hadn't never voted, they're going. And you could hear conversations, oh yeah, I lost my friend, or I lost my comadre. And then I even shared, yes, I've lost many friends.
Hernandez says she's hopeful a Biden administration would help bring a quicker end to the COVID-19 pandemic and bring together a divided country. I'm Reynaldo Llanos Jr. in Mission.
That's your coronavirus update for this Monday, November 2nd, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Here are some of the things coming up. First, we'll bring you USA Today. That's on the way at 2 o'clock with national news. Our local newspapers will be airing at 3, and here are some of those stories that will be read. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, virus resurgence sends oil prices to 4-month low. U.S. rig count closes on 300. Price of gas doesn't change in Midland. Election 2020 voting Q&A, where 11th congressional district candidates stand on issues. From the Odessa American, 2020 early voters turn out. ECISD working to increase attendance. Candidates talk transparency. Local economy a mixed bag. And Tuesday is Election Day in U.S. Those articles and more coming up at 3. And then at 6, more news from the Wall Street Journal. As always, thank you for being with us today. We'll be back at 1. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The City of Odessa, in partnership with the University of Texas Permian Basin, has scheduled the second round of free mobile COVID-19 testing events at the following times, dates, and locations. September 23rd, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., UTPB Park Soccer Field Parking, East Loop 338 and Highway 191. September 30th, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., Sherwood Park, East 49th Street and Cordova Street parking lot. October 14th, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., Floyd Gwynn Park parking lot, 1015 North County Road West. Events are for City of Odessa and Ector County residents. First come, first serve. For more information, call 557-6557. That's 557-6557.
The energy sector is experiencing a historic shock because of the combination of lower demand due to the coronavirus and an escalation in production from Saudi Arabia and Russia. In these uncertain times, we invite you to join us for the weekly Business and Oil Report. Recording Library volunteers and staff read the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American Business and Oil pages.
Rig count plunges by 23 in Permian Basin.
Super majors prefer independents go bankrupt.
Local car dealers survives through downturn.
Here is the regular column by Dennis Ellen.
Permian Basin Better Business Bureau.
Parsley Pioneer ask RRC for market demand hearing.
The Economist by M. Ray Perryman.
Pioneer CEO Scott Sheffield. We really need Trump to do something or he's going to lose all the energy states in this election.
The Business and Oil Report, Friday mornings at 6 and repeated Sunday nights at 7 and Thursdays at 4 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Dermatitis trigger more stress. Dear Dr. Roach, like everyone, I have been using a lot of hand sanitizer and a lot of disinfecting wipes throughout the day. Do these sanitizing products get absorbed through the skin and build up in our bodies? I ask because I have come down with a difficult case of seborrheic dermatitis on my face, though I don't use any of these products on my face. My facial skin has always been hypersensitive, so I was thinking, if this is my weak spot, maybe the ill effects of the sanitizers and disinfecting wipes would show up there. Answer. Hand sanitizers use alcohol to kill bacteria and disable viruses. The alcohols used in approved sanitizers are not well absorbed through the skin, but if they were, your body is able to metabolize the small amounts that come through. Seborrheic dermatitis is a common skin condition. Although its cause is not well understood, it is clearly triggered by stress in many people. Since many of us are stressed from work changes and from dramatic changes to our social interactions, I think it's more likely to be related to stress than to hand sanitizer use. Any dry skin might cause problems, so using some hand lotion might help. Jesus breathes out in the street.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 69 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, it's the USA Today for November 2nd. Gosh, November 2nd, 2020. And tomorrow is Election Day, and that's the headline for the USA Today. I'm reading off an iPad, so I'm not exactly sure what's in the news paper.